spiritual community and then can log in at moments like this and see folks from all over the world, which is just such an incredible treat. See some old Dharma friends as well, which is also, of course, such a treat. So we'll begin just with a sit and then shift into this topic about the parami of simplicity and renunciation. So we can find for ourselves a comfortable posture. You can enjoy the sound of the bell as it fades. Finding a mindful, awake and alert body posture to sustain your heart and mind through our practice. And we'll just enjoy a few more breaths together and practice. Breathing in, aware that we're breathing in. And breathing out, aware that we're breathing out. You can just enjoy the sound of the bell as it fades. If you need to just wiggle your toes, stretch a little bit, just giving your body what it needs. Coming back. All right. It's nice to see folks from all over. As I mentioned, feel free to drop in the chat where you're from. Crete, I was there a couple of years ago. Beautiful spot. Always wanted to go to New Zealand, France, wonderful. So many folks in England, London, Florida, other parts of Massachusetts, Philly, Maine, California, Stockholm, Bulgaria. Cheltenham, I've actually been to Cheltenham, Portugal, of course, Ohio, Michigan, Scotland. Nice, very nice. So today's topic is simplicity. And this is kind of my modern interpretation of the parami or paramita of renunciation. Renunciation, we think of that as, going off to live on a mountaintop, like a monk or something like that, renouncing all of our worldly possessions in these different ways. And that's tough to do in today's world on many, many levels. And it's tough to do as, what we call in Buddhism, in Dharma, householders. Most of us aren't monks. We're not reliant on the community for support in every way. We've got responsibilities to maybe to our own kids or to friends or to families or to work, maybe even to our own aging parents. This total renunciation of everything in the world is pretty tough to do. So to me, I think this idea then of simplicity and more simple living actually really makes a lot of sense. And yet it's hard, it's tricky in this world. And so much of the world that we're living in runs counter to that. We've got oftentimes smaller families in some ways, but many of us have bigger houses, drive bigger cars, and have just so much more stuff than even when we were growing up. Right? The world has changed. We've got this, rise in cheap labor. Prices have dropped on almost everything, right? It's easy to buy. It's easy to consume more, right? Houseware, furniture, clothes, you name it. I was actually shopping with my kids on Friday. My son wanted some sneakers and they were $65 for a pair of Nikes. I remember thinking, I remember when I, in like 1992, I remember my mom saying, you can't spend more than $65. It's like some prices have hardly changed in a lot of ways, right? Because of, the cheap labor and globalization and all different kinds of externalities and shortcuts that, of course, also have their own consequences of unfair labor practices and environmental devastation in terms of the way that we live things. We have other things that we have a lot of too, right? We can just buy stuff with the click of a button. Amazon delivers it allegedly by drone soon enough, right? We spend so much money, despite all of our stuff, on storage space. Right. And we have more digital stuff too, right? We've got, I was reading something recently about digital detritus, like all those wonderful mindfulness summits and talks that we buy and then never actually listen to or watch or subscribe to, right? And yet we've also got all this just instant entertainment at the, tip of our fingers all the time. And yet, all this freedom of choice, right? Whether it's, the different hundreds of kinds of toothpaste at the supermarket, to swiping for our relationships, to, what self-improvement book should I do? What spiritual path should I follow? Which guru, what kind of psychotherapy should I do to be happier? It actually has left us all this choice that's supposed to be freedom, has left us more stressed, lonelier, less happy, less motivated. And all this crap that we have. Remember, it was actually about 20 years ago now, the Onion, the great kind of satirical newspaper some of us are familiar with. Remember, yeah, about 20 years ago, there was this headline that said, "Consumer product diversity now exceeds biodiversity," right? It's this idea of, we have so much more stuff, but we're not paying attention to the environment, right? And it's worse actually in quote unquote Western countries. As options grow as consumers, we actually have less happiness, even with more stuff, with more choices. So-called Western cultures, modernizing cultures, right, lead the world in depression and anxiety, mental health issues for all ages. And that paradox of choice is really exhausting. Right? We think it's liberating to have more choices of toothpaste, but actually what happens is it exhausts our brain, this part of the brain right here, the prefrontal cortex. That's where we make decisions and regulate our emotions and kind of manage our impulses, see the future, all these, different kinds of things, right? That gets exhausted by making so many choices. And so we actually end up more susceptible to stress, more susceptible to emotional dysregulation, grumpiness, grouchiness, struggling with impulse control in other ways, right? Actually, by having all these choices. And we can look at the spiritual world and see how monks, clergy, spiritual ascetics, right? They often take that vow of poverty, the Buddha himself, right? Relinquishing the comforts of life. And we can't very easily, most of us just toss all our possessions and find happiness, that way, right? Even the Buddha himself found the middle path, right? He inherited all this stuff. He was this prince, had anything he could ever want, basically grew up in this gated community, right? Never saw any suffering in the world. He encountered it. He was like, forget it, I'm renouncing all of it. Get rid of everything. I'm gonna eat one grain of rice a day. And then he realized that that actually wasn't great either, right? It was finding that middle ground, right? And that word renunciation, I think, does sound harsh, right? And that is where I like that idea of simplification, or letting go, I think, is maybe the name of the talk, or even making space, right? Right? When we let go of things, we actually make space for other things to come in. Perhaps we let go of stuff. Well, we make room for other stuff, but maybe we also make room for the spiritual to come in, the sacred, the mystery. We make space for all of that when we do a little bit of letting go on a few different levels. And one of the things I like about Buddhism, there are many, but one is it's got all these lists, right? And Buddhism, which is kind of predicated on the noble truths, which talk about how it's often our attachment that makes us suffer, and talking about four kinds of attachment, actually, that the Buddha talked about. There's attachment to things and pleasure, right? That's often what we think of when we think of materialism. There's also attachment to unhealthy habits, which I think, that worship of busyness that we all have in the modern world, right? I gotta do this thing, I gotta do that next thing, right? There's that meme that says, adulthood is just saying over and over again, maybe after next week things will calm down until you die. Like, I mean, it's a little dark, but that worship of busyness and habits, right? Not so great, creates more suffering. Another thing that we attach to, that we cling to, that creates suffering is wrong view, right? Often our views, our perspectives, right? We get attached to these in a lot of ways, right? And these actually make us suffer. In the psychotherapy world, we call these limiting beliefs, emotional baggage. In the recovery world, right, we think about these as resentments, right, character defects. And then lastly, the thing that we cling to that is maybe not so helpful for us and creates more suffering is identity. And that's pretty abstract. We'll try to get into that. In this short amount of time, we've got a half hour to get into all this. We'll see how we do. Actually, I was recently asked to do, someone asked me, will you do a talk on simplicity, a workshop on simplicity and the science of simplicity? I said, sure. And they said, we do 6 hours. And I thought, I don't know if I could do 6 hours on simplicity. I ended up doing four and was actually very surprised at how much more I could have done. But we can get started with these four kinds of attachment, right? And these four kinds of letting go. Right, we've got the pleasure in things, we've got the habits, we've got the views and identity. So this idea of stuff, and as I mentioned, we all have so much more stuff in many ways than we ever used to, or it's just so much easier to have so much stuff, right? And this is many kinds of things, right? It's the houses and the cars, and it's also the jobs and these other kinds of external measures that we think of as success in different ways. It also is oftentimes other kinds of things, right? This sort of desire for more, right? I joke with people a lot. I often listen to self-help books and Dharma books on double speed, right? Which is like, am I trying to get myself more enlightenment here, get there faster? Like, or would I maybe be better off if I actually just even listen to one book on half speed? I probably would be better off if I simplified rather than quantity, maybe going deeper, going for quality. Right? And we live in this world too, where it's hard to resist, right? We're barraged with advertisements all over the place, advertisements for stuff, right? Advertisements for substances and intoxicants, right? Whether it's, the cannabis store or the alcohol store or medications that might help, in some ways. Whether it's, I've been watching soccer with my son, all the advertisements for gambling, make it rich, right? Advertisements for more cheap entertainment, distractions, advertisements to change our body, right? And all of it, sometimes it's advertisements for stuff, but underneath it is this promise of happiness, right? Corporations spend billions and billions of dollars, 200-fold increase in marketing budgets in the last 30 years, right? Hiring behavioral scientists, other psychologists, right? Scanning people's brains to see how to get them to hit that buy button because we need more, we need more. Right? Get that dopamine hit of buying something else, buying something else. Right? So we're swimming up against the stream. The Buddha talked about that thousands of years ago. It's still up against the stream. So what can we do? Right? Well, we can try to understand at first, just identify, okay, this marketing, right, is trying to fool our brains. We can set limits around how much we buy in different ways. Right? Whether it's, buying things for ourselves or just waiting for special occasions, buying things for other people, we can just slow down. Right? Do I need this now? With my own kids, they're asking me, I can't remember what it was, something ridiculous the other day. And I was like, I'll spend my own money on it. I'm like, why don't we keep walking around? If you still want it at the end of the day, we can get it. But doing that for ourselves too. And finding these ways to let go. I think of what we do have. I think about, actually was just at a bookstore yesterday, and there was a book that was like, I can't remember what exactly it was called, but it was like, The Joy of Getting Rid of All Your Stuff Before You Die, so that your kids don't inherit it. I was thinking about that. And my parents' house, actually, about 10 years ago, was destroyed in a fire. Like, I mean, it was also like 2 weeks before Christmas. My parents were fine, right? But they lost almost everything. Like books, clothing, heirlooms, a lot of the Christmas gifts, a lot of my childhood memorabilia, a lot of memories in some ways. And, it was heartbreaking. It was terrifying. I just remember talking with my sister. It was also a little bit of a relief that there was a burden lifted of not having to do all that sorting. So getting rid of stuff can be a really liberating practice, right? And you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Or Marie Kondo and the life-changing magic of tidying up, right? Only keeping what sparks joy. Right? These kinds of things. I know it's kind of silly and fun to make fun of Marie Kondo, but it's kind of great, this idea of just keeping what sparks joy. My family was out of town. I was sorting through the stacks and stacks of artwork and other stuff while they were gone. And you know, we have this impulse to keep everything so often. That's part of human nature. It's who we are. We need it for survival, this kind of hoarding instinct. But also when we just keep a few things, that actually lets them shine in this really amazing way. I can keep 20 pieces of artwork from my kids, or I can keep that one that really captures something, and then it really pops out on the wall. I can keep 50 heirlooms from my parents, so I can just keep those one or two that really remind me of them in some more profound way. That's part of what that process of letting go is, right? But it's not easy. We have all these built-in biases toward keeping more stuff, hoarding more stuff, sunk cost fallacy. These other kinds of things that are wired into us that make it really hard to let go. So learning how to motivate ourselves, sometimes it is around thinking about how do these things align with our beliefs? Do I want to buy all this stuff from a company whose values I really dislike? Right? Every time I'm buying something from this company, I'm putting money into the pocket of, you know, someone who I really don't support. Every time I buy this car, every time I buy, right, this other thing, right? How does that support politics I disagree with, social policies I disagree with, environmental policies I disagree with? How does buying this stuff impact the environment, impact sustainability? Can I try to buy more things used, gently used, not put more plastic, more stuff into the world? Sometimes that can really help me motivate, but it's not easy to do this. So finding these ways to make our decisions about ethical consumption of stuff can be helpful when we think about what are the ethics of this. And some basics there too, oftentimes, right? Whether it's, you know, not buying something new until we can, you know, get rid of something old. Thinking about other ways to get rid of stuff, to reframe how we get rid of it, that we're sharing it, giving it to someone who needs it. And we can shop according to our values, right? Do I really need this? Is it functional? Is it sustainable for the environment? Is it ethical in terms of the people who are profiting from this? Is it well made, right? Can I buy this for life, or buy it for a long time anyway? Is it durable, or is it basically disposable? Do I have the space for it? Do I have the energy to care for it? Is it affordable financially? Is it affordable in other ways? Does it spark joy? Right? And how does it help my health or my mental health? Or how does it maybe help my personal growth in some way too? So these are some ways we can think about less material consumption in the world. And then there's the unhealthy habits thing, right? How busy we all are, right? And how challenging this can be. We're all so addicted to busyness. In fact, busyness actually creates this dopamine cycle too, where we get this little hit of being busy and multitasking and doing this and doing that, and it feels good. We feel important. It actually, busyness, it kind of reifies our ego, and we know that we're trying on this spiritual path to reduce our ego, but staying busy makes us feel important. Feeling important, right, kind of consolidates our ego in some ways. Right? The multitasking that we think we can do, and actually, very few of us can multitask. I learned recently, I think it's 0.5% of the population can multitask, and that's entirely women, pretty much, which is not so surprising. But most of us, we try to multitask, we just end up actually wearing out our prefrontal cortex, right? Which makes us more grumpy, more susceptible to bad choices, more susceptible to our impulses, right? To acting out in ways that we're not so happy about. That busyness that we all practice is not so great. Trying to slow down and just do a little bit less. There's this awesome article, which I'm too busy to read, I have to say, but this very funny article, I believe it was in the New York Times, about a not doing anything contest. I don't know if anyone saw this article. I should, I feel like I should share it with everybody, but it was, I'm looking for it right now. But it was very funny, a contest of just not doing anything, right? Kind of love it. This idea. I was listening to a podcast at the beginning of the year also about Ezra Klein talking about some of his New Year's resolutions, but one was just to do less, and that sometimes we think about self-care, right? Well, I'll self-care, I'll relax. And I know I can get into like, oh, I'll relax. And how many self-help books can I read this week, right? Or I'll get some, I'll take care of myself. I'll go to the gym. Well, can I run faster today than I did yesterday? Can I lift more weights today than I did yesterday? And that is also its own form. Like, what is really unplugging? What is truly doing less, right? Or doing nothing? Can we actually do nothing? This idea that so many spiritual traditions have of holidays, holy days, Sabbaths, Shabbats, whatever it is that we call them, days of rest, it's really a wonderful idea. And I used to actually try to do this regularly before we had kids. I would get a little bit addicted to work and trying to just like, okay, Saturdays, we're just gonna like not check our emails, like truly not do anything. Work related. Anyway, we're still cooking, we're still, you know, all that stuff, but to really find a day that's kind of sacred without work. One of the things I found by doing that is actually made me more efficient than on the next day, because I'd be like, oh no, I'm not going to do that Saturday, so I better get it done before Saturday, right? And then, you know, I'll get it done afterwards. But actually made me honor that day and actually made me more efficient in other days of the week at other times. So whether it's, you know, a Sabbath day, a Sabbath morning, or whatever you want to call it, a day of mindfulness, a do one thing at a time day, as I heard someone call it, a single tasking day, right? Or an hour. We find that time where we, you know, especially our phones that are always getting to us, where we leave our phone at home, or we don't get out our screens, or we, you know, a few hours before bed, we try to put them away, that this is renouncing some of that busyness that we all fall prey to, right? And thinking about how we can unschedule ourselves a little bit, or schedule in time to do nothing into our calendars. I've been trying to do that Friday mornings, just block out time, right? To do nothing, or to just take a walk without my phone, or to see a friend. To really kind of try to fit that in. So technology can be, in a sense, our enemy, but it can also be our friend a little bit as we try to let go a little bit of some of the busyness, the habits. And then the other thing, I think, in terms of that could create suffering, and we can also let go of the other attachment we often have, is our views, our perspectives. Sometimes that's our opinions. We can see how much right now, politically, socially, right, people just holding so tightly to their opinions is just creating so much suffering, instead of willing to listen or to let go or to entertain the idea of possibly being wrong in some ways. We know from social psychology too, that the more we often argue, people argue online or off, actually, the more entrenched they become in their positions, right? And get even more attached. So knowing when to let go, not get hooked, not get trolled in person or online, right? Because that keeps us more attached to our views. I know when I get into an argument with someone, and I think mindfulness for actually helped me become aware of this, whether it's in person or online, right? I spend the rest of the day thinking about it. It's like, what's going to be my comeback later? I don't like that about myself, right? I don't have to beat myself up for it, but I get attached to these views. It's like I just gotta get that mic drop, kind of comment back to them on Facebook, or I'm gonna, tell that person, I'm still annoyed at. I'm gonna make that passive aggressive comment later to my in-laws or whoever it is, right? Because I get so attached to being right. Doesn't make me happy. Doesn't make space, right? Think about renunciation as making space. It makes space for nothing else. It crowds out joy. It crowds out fun. It crowds out creative ideas. It crowds out, being able to focus on driving. It crowds out being able to focus on what I do love about people or the world. Holding on really tight to those perspectives. We hold on tight to other perspectives too, often ones that we've inherited. Right? I think about kind of talking, I guess, mortality and thinking about parents and generations these days, but thinking about all that stuff I didn't have to inherit from my parents when their house burned down. But thinking about all that stuff, that emotional baggage that I inherited, those beliefs that my parents had about the world, those rituals maybe that weren't necessarily so fun or so helpful, those judgments that I inherited, right? I find myself, falling into the same habits that I saw my parents fall into, make the same mistakes oftentimes, make the same parenting mistakes or, similar kinds of struggles in work, right? How can I let go of that from my family of origin? Well, first I have to become aware of it through mindfulness, right? What other beliefs, what other cultural beliefs can I unlearn? From being a white cisgendered guy, with lots of degrees and lots of privilege sitting here in my own house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Super safe, super privileged, right? What kind of unlearning of beliefs? Beliefs of, I did this all myself. These are meritocratic beliefs. It's like, oh no, actually, I had a lot of privilege and luck and stuff along the way too to get to where I am, right? What are some of these unconscious beliefs, right, that many of us have been trying to learn about social justice over these past few years that we've been unaware of, that society has just shaped us? Beliefs about other gender identity, beliefs about other racial groups, beliefs about our own aspects of identity in these different ways. Right? Doing that work to unlearn a lot of that, to unlearn some of those habits, those beliefs, those prejudices from society, from parents, from family, from the popular culture. These also we can let go of, simplify, and just see people as they are, see ourselves, see the world more clearly. Again, that's what mindfulness helps us do, is it takes off the judgments, whether it's the judgments about the person, the judgments about the emotion, the judgments about myself, the judgments about the, the color of the neighbor's house, right? These things to just let go of, simplify, see things as they are in their essence, to let go. And then identity being another one. We hold fast to our identity, and some of that goes along with those identity markers, right? I'm, white cis guy. I could judge myself in this way or that way for these different things, right? Can I let go of certain aspects of my identity? Some I can, some I can't, some are placed upon me, but some ways that I conceive of myself, that critical voice in particular, right? I'm terrible at this. I wrote a book proposal just rejected by 10 publishers, right? I could decide, oh, I'm a failure. Well, that's one identity, but I've written some other books. Oh, I'm a success, right? That's another identity I can hold on to or I can let go I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, or I'm a person in recovery, right? How can I hold these identities? How do identities liberate us? Sometimes saying I'm an addict can be liberating with that identity. And sometimes it can also be limiting in certain ways. Or, I'm a person with depression or a person with anxiety, or I'm anxious and will always be anxious. Thinking about these different ways that we hold fast to identity. I've actually been talking a lot with a friend who's an anxiety expert, writer, speaker. about some of these ways that in the mental health world, right, this kind of holding on to identity can be so liberating to have a diagnosis. Oh, what a relief. But then also at some point, we have to outgrow that diagnosis and be bigger than it, be more than it for us to recover, to get better, to heal in these different ways. And it's not like holding that identity is bad or letting go of it is good. It's mixed. It's much more of a both and, but can we hold some of these things lightly so that identity can be there to liberate us, not just to keep us stuck and keep us from growing, right? I experience this thing, I'll always be this way. Maybe so, maybe not. We hold it a bit more lightly as we learn how to let go a little bit of some aspects of our identity. Because some things will change over time, right? Will I always be, if I hold on to always being a teacher, right? Well, then I never would have become a therapist. If I hold on to always being a parent, well, I will always be a parent, but how will I let go of my kids when they're older? Right? All of these kinds of things, right? We let go of some aspects of identity. We allow new ones to come in that fit us for the moment at hand. So exploring these different ways of letting go and simplifying renunciation, simplicity, right? We know that consumption doesn't help us. The Buddha taught it, the scientists backed it up, right? Trying to buy a little bit less stuff, shopping a little bit more ethically. When we do purchase, we can try to also buy things like experiences, which are often longer lasting and do actually create happiness more than just stuff. Although I find for myself, I often then become greedy about experiences, right? How many passport stamps can I get? Right? How many ticket stubs can I have? Museums can I get to? Right? We can make materialism out of anything. We can also find ways to let go, to simplify. Actually, traveling is a great way, or going camping. Remember, traveling, getting back from backpacking around Asia with my now wife 20 years ago, getting home and thinking, oh my gosh, all that stuff I didn't need. Look at all the stuff I have. Just lived out of a backpack. It can just be a good reminder, travel or camping. Right? Letting go of stuff, getting rid of our stuff with what sparks joy or helping it find a new, happier home. Learning how to let go of busyness by scheduling emptiness, scheduling nothing when we can do that. Meditating, reading that article about the doing nothing contest, which I'll try to send everybody later on. Right? Those sacred days, sacred hours where we're trying to do nothing or just connect, just be rather than doing, just being. Other kinds of ways of letting go of some of our beliefs, our limiting beliefs, our stinking thinking, our cognitive distortions, we call them in cognitive therapy, these perspectives that are maybe not wrong, but maybe we just invite ourselves to wonder if they're always right. Is everything as bad as it seems? Maybe, maybe not. Right? Is this terrible thing going to happen? Maybe, maybe not. Allowing some space, simplicity, renunciation to create space for it to maybe not be true, or space for a solution to arise for some of these worries or concerns that we have. And lastly, learning to let go a bit of our identities to make room for new identities to come in and to let go a bit of our egos at the same time that I must be seen as the good Dharma teacher, the good dad, the good writer, the good therapist, right? And allow other aspects of identity to come in. So these are a few thoughts on simplicity and simplification. As I mentioned too, just finding these ways to let go of the stuff, let go of the habits and busyness, let go of some of the beliefs, and let go and simplify some aspects of our ego. So I see some questions popping in. Thank you all. I'm seeing here struggling with volume. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, everybody. I'm seeing these questions now. All right, I'm seeing some really nice comments and questions. It looks like during the meditation with some of the quietness, you could probably hear my kids screaming in the background, is actually probably what you are hearing. The space that we occupy, this is a really fun question, right? Thinking about, especially here in the US and also many parts of the world, homelessness and housing crunches, and how much space are we all taking up, right? What are we allowing to build or not build? Are we making good choices around housing policies when it comes to politics? These different kinds of things. This question of space can be a luxury, even an ethical consideration. I think this is a really important one, right? We can think about people. I mean, I'm here in my city, 4th of July weekend. It's a pretty wealthy area where I live, and it's very quiet here because a lot of people are at their second homes and that kind of thing. Well, many people are struggling at the same time with finding any housing at all. These are really challenging questions, I think. I do think this question of how do we consume physical space in terms of housing, but in other ways too. I think about some of the, even privileges of, kind of the space that, one is allowed to take up as someone who identifies as a man versus someone who identifies as a woman, right, is very different, right? As a white person as opposed to a person of color or a marginalized person in our society, how much physical space, emotional space, participatory space are we allowed to take up? I think even just on the subway or on the airplane, not like man spreading, being something as well. So I think these are really interesting questions for us to consider in terms of space at the macro level of housing, even at the micro level of our bodies. Can we inhabit the space that we are entitled to and no more? Kids and phones. Woof, woof, woof. Oh my gosh. Oh, there's the space out competition. Thank you, Reed. There it is. Right. Current, thank you, Ruth. Holding on to beliefs can crowd out joy. I think this is really, I actually didn't plan on talking about that. It just kind of came to me today as I thought about some of the struggles I've had recently, holding on to some certain resentments. In my life, how they're crowding out joy. And then thinking too about phones and screens. I think we need to model it, especially with young people. Like, there's that old story about, someone in India, 70 years ago, brought their son to see Gandhi and said, will you teach him how to not, he eats sweets all the time. Have him not eat sweets. And Gandhi said, well, you have to give me 2 weeks and come back. And the woman came back 2 weeks later and said, well, what was going on for the last 2 weeks? And Gandhi said, well, I had to stop eating sweets before I could tell him. And I think we adults need to be aware of that with our own phones. This has been very hard for me as a parent to try to put my phone away, to try to keep my phone away, despite literally preaching about the dangers of digital devices. I find myself also quite addicted. I do think this is something that the more we educate ourselves and educate our kids, and it is never too late, about the fact that these devices were designed to be addictive. I think that's one of the best ways that we can help empower all of us to stay away from our phones. I mean, I think about, going to the park with my kids or something, and it's like, well, I don't need to bring my phone. I'm like, well, what if I need to text my wife something? Or, oh my gosh, my kids are so cute. I got to take a picture of them. I was like, what if I think of something for my grocery list? It's like, it's everything in one. So it's very hard to not bring with us wherever we go. So what Silicon Valley talks about is making everything frictionless. Like, so you can just seamlessly, like within the minimum number of clicks, you buy something and it gets sent to your house, right? Basically. And so it's about adding in more friction. I think oftentimes about, like, leave my phone in my bag instead of in my pocket, leave it in the car instead of in my bag, leave it at home instead of in the car. These kinds of things, phone-free spaces, phone-free times, phone-free days can be helpful. But what I was going to say about educating ourselves, one of the most effective anti-smoking campaigns in like the late 90s, early 2000s was called the Truth Campaign. It's been studied a lot by like public health people because it was so effective. What the Truth Campaign did was that it wasn't like, don't smoke, it's bad for you, because everyone knows it's bad for you. Just like we all know, none of us want to be on our phones. Even our 15-year-olds don't want to be on their phones as much as they are. What that campaign did was it would have these, it would say like the tobacco companies are fooling you. And they'd have these like, black and white videos of all these like old guys, sitting around a room talking about how they were going to fool kids into smoking. And it was really an effective campaign because no one likes being fooled. And so actually, when we educate ourselves about the addictiveness of these devices, how they have been engineered by behavioral scientists and evil psychologists, unlike myself, there's an identity I'm clinging to, not being an evil psychologist, right? But that when we educate ourselves that these are designed to be maximally addictive, and here are all of the tricks that they use, right? Then it starts to be like, well, you know what? F that. I don't want to be pulled in and fooled. And I actually saw a really sweet little video clip. It was Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard, who actually never listened to their podcast. It's supposed to be great. The Armchair Expert Cop podcast. But I saw a clip, maybe it was with Jonathan Haidt, who wrote The Anxious Generation, which is a great book on this topic. But they were saying, Kristen Bell was saying that she's like, she will just out loud in front of her kids be like, oh, my phone, it's tricking me. It's trying to get me to, get it to look at it again. I hate it when it does that. It's just, it's tricking me. And so that as adults, we can model that these things are trying to trick us, and it empowers all of us to feel a little bit more like, you know what? Like, I want to fight back. I don't like being tricked in this way. I could talk for like literally hours about that. Thank you, Lynn. Letting go of toxic relationships. Oh, this is so hard. This is so hard. This is so hard. I think like everything, letting go is hard. I think again, understanding whether it's through science or social science or through what the Buddha teaches or through a topic I found very interesting. This sounds very pretentious, but it's really interesting. It's called neuroeconomics, but it's about a lot of our cognitive biases. Are things like that we do as humans fall into, what's called like the sunk cost fallacy. Like the more time we spend on things, right, the harder it is to let go of them, whether that's a relationship, whether that's a job, whether that's a project at work, right, that we feel we have invested time into these things and effort into these things. And it is very, very hard to override that. I think it's also, we have these things, people, relationships in our lives for a reason. They are doing something for us, right? They are doing something positive, or they are getting some need met, even if it's not in the way that is ultimately actually that healthy for us. And so we have to, I mean, even with the good stuff in our life, it's sometimes it's easier to, get something, out of our life, before we bring something new in. And yet sometimes also finding ways to get some of those needs met before and as we move something out can be really helpful. So a relationship, for example, I think, when we can build ourselves up a community of other people who we can really count on for a time if we know we're going to have to go through a difficult breakup. Again, whether that's a breakup with a toxic person, a toxic workplace, to save up some money and think about what else we can do in that time, to break up with a toxic habit or substance, as I've done in my own life, a few times, in these past few decades, right? It's like you have to find other things in your life that bring you some of that meaning and give you some of that, and come, I think, to some degree of acceptance around, this is going to be painful. And I can add suffering onto that or not, but it is definitely going to be very painful. And that's where having a community, maybe it's the community here, other wonderful people, maybe a community of other people in your life who can support you through that, Can be really helpful. And leaning into the healthy, healing, non-toxic, empowering relationships that you do have in your life that can boost you up through something like that. And that there's grief involved even in letting go of something that's toxic and not good for us. And you don't have to beat yourself up for feeling sad, feeling guilty, feeling scared. There's a lot to be said about that. And there's a lot of people wiser than me who probably have advice on that that question reflection too. Thank you for raising that. And I'm sure you're not the only person in this room of 77 people who either are struggling with that question or have struggled with that question in their own life. So thank you for your vulnerability in sharing that question. I think as we, Tammy's pointing out too, we do better when we, look at our lives beyond ourselves. When we look at our larger community, when we look at the world, it makes it easier to simplify, to, what's the saying, live simply so that others may simply live, that kind of bumper sticker wisdom that actually is really profound. But when we look in a bigger way, we can start to see that. When we do things as simple as, calculating what's our carbon footprint for the year, or looking at these other externalities that we have, right? We can see the impact, and we can then think about making different choices or think about the impact that we have. And in some ways, there's sort of like there's no such thing as perfectly ethical consumption in every way, right? We're always somewhat complicit, really, unless we are monks and they probably have their own problems too. But being kind to ourselves at the same time, it's also about that middle path too. But striving to do a little bit better all the time as well. I have all these therapist mugs and says, "How does that make you feel?" But I have one that has Chogyam Trungpa's quote on it. "You're perfect just as you are, and you could use a little improvement," or something along those lines, right? And it's true, right? We could all do a little bit better around our consumption, really striving to do that. Just like camping, just like traveling, Hazel, the lockdowns and the pandemic, right? It can make us aware of how easy it is to do less, right? Driving our car less, traveling less, eating local food, eating less, reducing our energy use, enjoying, that was the longest staycation any of us ever had, was that pandemic, right? And really got to appreciate our houses. Really, if we had a garden, did some major work in the garden and, making our homes beautiful. It really is the case. We've had this beautiful weekend where I am in outside of Boston. And my family was away for the weekend, visiting my in-laws, and they got back, and I realized I hadn't been in the car like in 3 days. Like, the car was like just covered in dust, and I got to go grocery shopping later. I've just been on my bicycle all weekend, or just on foot all weekend, and really simple. The truth can't. Thank you, Ruth. Yeah, like mindfulness, and I love it. And it's hard with our 14-year-olds. It's hard. It's about it's I think it's just about talking about it, modeling it, not push pull too hard. It's tough. Letting go of the gray tinted glasses. I mean, to me, I think that's a little bit of the renunciation. There's some renunciation there, right? It's really hard because we don't. When we're living with gray colored glasses, we don't know that we're living with gray colored glasses. When we're depressed, we don't realize that we're depressed, right? My disease, tells me that I don't have a disease, right? All of this kind of thing. My society tells me that my society is perfect. It takes a lot of mindfulness and awareness and slow process of waking up and being open and honest to be able to start to see clearly, or see the grayness in our perspectives, see the distortions in our perspectives. And I think Just inviting ourselves to, I think mindfulness can be helpful. I think, deliberately reminding ourselves that thoughts are just thoughts. When I say, the, I don't know, I don't know what's a negative thought. I've got plenty. Why can't I think of one off the cuff? My in-laws are driving me crazy, for example. I can remind myself I'm having the thought that my in-laws, are crazy or something like that. Or I'm having the thought that I'll never be able to give up this particular habit that I'm struggling with right now. Or even, especially when it comes to those gray negative thoughts about ourselves. We call that stinking thinking. We call that cognitive distortions. We call that all kinds of things. But sometimes just sort of writing down, we all have that like top 10 list, like the top 10 Spotify playlist of our negative thoughts, right? But writing down some of the, here's your worst thoughts of the year. But writing some of those down and just looking at them and asking yourself, is that really true? Right. It's probably true, but is it absolutely true, or is it just a thought? Right. It can be really helpful. Is it really true that, I'm a terrible writer, or am I just having the thought that I'm a terrible writer right now because I had some rejections? Right. Is it really true that, I'm a bad father, or am I just having, the thought that I'm a bad father? Right. Is it true that I'll never get another book contract, or is it true that I, just haven't gotten that one yet? Right. These different things, for whatever, insert your challenge here. Letting go of expecting outcomes. Oh my God. I mean, that is something to let go of, right? And that's like the catch 22 of all of this, the paradox of like, we're sitting to get enlightened, or we're sitting to get happy, or we're sitting, but if we sit with too much intention or any intention, we also hear that then that makes it worse, right? Attachment to outcomes. And there's, the recovery saying of, expectations are resentments waiting to happen, or disappointments waiting to happen. Something will happen, probably with meditation. We just never know what. So letting go of some of those expectations and opening to whatever it is that might arise, right? Is my own critical voice entirely shut off after 25 years of practice? No, but have I gone from calling myself a fucking idiot to, oh, you moron. Like there's 25 years of progress, maybe. It's progress, not perfection. Certain kinds of, mentalities lead to these sort of subtle hoarding impulses. Certain times, and we've had certain experiences in our lives can create some of that, desire to hold on to more, or we feel like we haven't been given things in our lives, right? We feel like we have to hold on to more oftentimes, right? This is a thing that many of us struggle with. There's a lot of fear there of letting go of certain kinds of things, right? To let go of certain things. Thank you, Jonah, for clarifying Suzuki Roshi, not Shogyam Trungpa. Well, thank you all for your question. I'm just like dopamine, rapid fire, answering questions here, responding to questions. I have a friend that says, if anyone has questions, I have responses. I don't have any answers. That's often how I feel. And I do want to encourage you. I really do just have responses. Seek out responses to these very same questions from other people, not just from me. Seek them out from other people in this really nice Sangha Live community. Seek them out from in-person Sanghas. Seek out responses and ideas to these questions in many ways, to in other aspects of your life too. It is also, I just want to thank you all for being here. It's just so wonderful to be in community, to be in the Dharma. My own journey started, in Dharma many years ago, and then it sort of shifted a lot more toward kind of science and neuroscience and other stuff. And in recent years, I've been really making a return to the Dharma, and there's just so much depth here in these practices, and so much. I'm aware of how many of my answers go back to, or my responses go back to mindfulness, wisdom, and clear seeing that arises from mindfulness. And Lynn, I really appreciate this, attachment to the false sense of safety, right? False senses of security that often are actually just a sense of familiarity to us, and familiarity can feel like safety is often a big part of it too. Beautiful, beautiful questions. Beautiful, beautiful conversation. Beautiful people here today. As as we heard at the beginning, Sangha Live doesn't run itself. So please offer some dana to keep it running, because this is a really beautiful community. If you have something you can let go of, then let go. Thank you all very, very much.
Okay, so thank you, Chris. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I was a bit lost in the last few minutes with the chat because there was this question from Diana. I don't know if you addressed it, if you saw it, if it was in the common space. It was quite.
Yeah, I saw that there was a something about someone's question, and I'm not seeing the question, just references to a question.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe you have time to address it. I could read it.
Sure.
Or
Yeah.
letting go of poverty mindset.
Oh, yeah. I touched on that very quickly at the end.
Okay.
I think this is a very tricky one. And I do think, it's not, we can't let go of everything, because we do have safety needs, we do have security needs. Some of us, have many more privileges than others in terms of what some of those questions are. And that's a place, I think, where, discernment from our own practice can be really helpful. Discernment through Sangha and the larger community can certainly be helpful to see, where do I have what I need? Where do I have what I need and a little bit more? And where am I, actually on that line of maybe, more than I truly need, in a way that's not so ultimately helpful or fruitful for me in this certain way. So it's a really challenging question. And I think all of these, as I said, continuing, I don't have always an answer, but often have a response. But exploring all these questions as questions, that there isn't always just like, here's the answer, but that often is the more we ask questions, it's a bit like a koan, like more is perpetually revealed in some ways as we continue to ask these questions of ourselves and others too. So thank you.
Okay, so thank you. And maybe just share a bit of a small tip. You were speaking, and Ruth asked about living. How can we just leave our smartphones? Well, I've found a way to treat my own mind, which is sometimes a few days that I don't really need to hold on to my phone when I leave the house. I just say to my mind, today I will deliberately forget my smartphone. And that works, because most of the times I find myself on the street, oh, I forgot my phone. Okay, so I'm not going to go back and pick it up. And so, I've been, forgetting my phone for a few times now, and it feels at the same time, so, oh, if someone needs to reach, how it's going to be. But then at the same time, it's so liberating because, okay, it's just sharing that bit of a tip. And thank you, Chris, for your session, a wonderful session, for being here. We'll hopefully have you back in a few
Think
months, a few
October.
weeks, I
Yeah.
think. Thank
Thank
you
you for
all.
your flexibility with changing my time around too. I appreciate
Thank
that.
you all for your